Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's January 27, 2014, and this is episode 406. This week I'm pleased to be joined once again by Don Komarechka. And you probably remember Don was on this podcast, I think it was exactly a year ago now. And a couple of times we've spoken mainly about printing because that's one of our common passions. But Don is a photographer based in Barrie, Ontario, Canada, and a fellow This Week in Photo co-host. So Don has recently self-published a book on his incredible snowflake photography and learned a lot in the process. So I'm going to be picking his brains today. So welcome back to the show, Don.
Thank you so much for having me again, Martin. And it's funny you mentioned that the project and picking my brains. That I made so many mistakes in this project and learned so much. So pick away. There's lots of juicy details that I'm sure everybody that's ever thought of something like this would find very useful.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. It's, you know, I know that this was your first time going through this process, but those mistakes are, you know, as we say, we learn by them. So I'm really looking forward to, because the only self-publishing I've done is one book years ago that I did on Blurb. And that was really for me and participants of the first winter workshop that I did in Hokkaido. So I haven't really done a self-published print book, I haven't done one at all. So I'm going to learn stuff today, and I hope that, as we say, you know, this sharing this with the audience is what it's all about. So let's jump into it.
All right. Well, let's start with Blurb. You mentioned that, and I want to know more about that project that you had put together. Did you create it using the Blurb software, or because I know that they let you upload PDFs and everything else inside of that as well?
Yeah.
For those that aren't familiar, Blurb is a service where you can basically create a book, whether you're using your own software like Adobe InDesign or some of the tools that they provide, and print them on demand.
Yeah.
And so I've done that as well. And my first book, my very first experiment with this kind of stuff, again, a couple of years ago as well, used it. And I was pretty happy with it. But there was a few downsides, a cost being one of them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. One of the reasons why I think exactly zero of the participants actually bought the book was because even though I added like a dollar for my time, they are expensive. In answer to your question, yes, I use the Blurb software, and I know that it's probably, I haven't downloaded it and installed it again since, but I think it was 2008 when I did this. So we're talking 6 years ago now. And the software itself wasn't bad. I wasn't totally, you know, displeased with the software. There are a few problems, and the main one being that relying on the Blurb software means that I no longer have a copy of that book because it disappeared with an old computer, and I don't recall ever being able to find a way to actually export the book in a format that I could use, and I didn't really think about it at the time. But yeah, I mean, you design the book in the Blurb software, and then you press upload, and it goes off to their site. And I spent a number of hours trying to do this. There was no way for me to even download the book from Blurb again. So, you know, and if anyone knows how to do this, then just let me know. I'm not sure if I really need it now. But I basically lost all of the work that I put into the book because it was all in the software. Whereas if I'd have done it in InDesign or something like that, I could have kept all of that. And so, you know, that's something to think about.
Right.
So yeah, the price though, it was expensive. I didn't find the software too bad. As soon as you put a book together with more than a few pages in it, to print on demand, it is expensive. But you know, I mean, normally if I was to go back to Blurb now, I would probably do it because I was going to not produce something that I wanted to have people buy as a book, like your book that we're going to be talking about today. It would probably be more for producing a bound portfolio of my work or things like that. So, you know, I probably view Blurb differently now than I did back then.
Well, I will be using Blurb again myself at some point in the future. I'm putting together a small portfolio of work. Last year, a little bit over a year ago now, I had gone on a trip into the Yukon wilderness. And it was a lot of fun. And the hunters that had taken me alongside them, I'm going to produce a sort of a small photo book of just the images taken there to give them as a gift.
Yeah.
And I might only be making 10 copies of it. So Blurb is the solution when you're printing in low volume like that.
Exactly. Yeah.
And yes, it's going to cost you a heck of a lot more per copy. But, and if we talk numbers, I think it's around, like, for an 80-page book, you know, an 8x10 kind of landscape style book, it might cost you around $45 or something. And that's your cost to order a book.
Yeah.
At least that's what the prices were at the time that I had done one a while back. They're probably similar today.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's a huge cost and very little in the way that, that you can mark that up before people get turned off by it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a good business model for Blurb. They're doing very well for themselves. Mm. But it doesn't really allow a photographer to sell their work. But it's great for a portfolio, like you said.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I'm going to be doing going forward, I think. And another thing to remember as well is now you can actually create your books in Lightroom and just send them straight to Blurb.
And that's so convenient.
Right. Right, and it gives you the, you know, you've got the spine area, so you can put your name in there. And I have played around with the books module in Lightroom since that was added. And so, you know, the problems that I had 6 years ago are probably gone away, and they've probably gone away even if you just use the Blurb software now. But that was my experience. But I think that they're great for low volume. But if you are going to do something where you need more than a handful of copies, then probably self-publishing is the way to go. But I mean, I'm sure that you didn't find it easy to do this either. So we're going to work through a few of those issues as we start to talk about this. So tell us about the book itself, Don. You know, I mean, obviously you're well known for your beautiful snowflake images, and I can imagine that, you know, I understand the reason why you wanted to put this together, but you know, obviously you had a lot of choices and how to actually go about this, which is what I want to talk about. So tell us first about the book itself.
Well, I knew that I was gathering content for a book, even though I hadn't really committed to do it yet. Mm. I'm kind of science-minded and technically oriented as a photographer, and a lot of my work reflects that, but you know, I have a desire to learn about the things that I photograph. Mm. You know, if it's photographing a bug that I haven't seen before, you know, I'll take the picture, then I'll run home and try and look it up and figure out what the heck's going on. Or yeah. You know, the same thing where I'll see something strange in a photograph and I want to try and figure that out. And snowflakes offer that kind of curiosity in abundance. Mm. So I started digging into all the fun science, and I started amassing a lot of research and knowledge on the topic of not just how to shoot them, but how they form and the physics involved. And I found that pretty fascinating. And I thought to myself, well, you know, if I think that's fascinating, I know I'm not exactly the average guy, but I'm sure there's other people out there that might find it interesting as well. Mm. You know, there's a big risk in putting that together. And the book has all the science and all the photographic techniques and everything that I wanted to make into it. Mm. So I made it as a book that I, as myself, would have loved to read.
Yeah.
But now that's risky, because I can't go and self-publish this and commit a huge amount of money to a book that I'm not sure anybody's going to buy. And so, you know, there was a few questions going back and forth. Well, if I put it on Blurb, what's the cost going to be? It was astronomical. It ended up being some stupid, crazy number, like, you know, $300 a copy or something silly.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just outside the realm of possibility. Mm. But I thought, well, if people are genuinely interested in this content, and it seemed to be that way, you know, I was starting to build up an audience online at the time. You know, a lot of my online audience and following has actually come directly from snowflakes.
Yeah.
For the past, this is year number 3 that I'm doing it. I've done what I call my snowflake a day project.
Yeah.
And actually, the day that we record this is the midpoint in this year's project. It's day number 50. I do it for 100 days of winter. That's about how much winter we have here. Mm. And so every day I'm posting a new image and engaging with people. And there was some genuine interest. So I thought, well, let's just throw this out there and see if a crowdfunding campaign was going to be a way that I can, you know, get this book up and running as far as, you know, gathering the funds to afford a production run and be able to promote and get books in the hands of people at the same time. So investigating that was what was interesting. Have you looked into that process at all, Martin?
I haven't. I've certainly thought about it. There's one product that I'm thinking to try to bring to market that it will cost a certain amount, a reasonably large amount, to actually create the initial stock. So I'm considering it, but you know, from my perspective, I'm not sure whether I'll do it or not. But of course, you know, the timing with the, you know, we're talking Kickstarter here. I think actually in Canada, you couldn't use Kickstarter, could you? It was a different company.
Kickstarter is now friendly to Canadians, but at the time that I was crowdfunding, it wasn't. You'd need to have a U.S. bank account, or you'd have to use some weird tricks to sign up for it. I used Indiegogo.
I remember now. Yeah,
they are a very similar service to Kickstarter in much the same way. They allow you to do either flexible funding or fixed funding. And for a project like this, the difference is fixed funding means that if you hit your goal, you get the money. If you don't hit your goal, then everybody keeps their money and you get nothing.
Yeah.
Where flexible funding means that you'll take all the money that's given into you, but you know, Indiegogo would take then a larger percentage of it.
I see.
Fixed funding, where, you know, if I didn't hit the goal, then nothing was done, that was perfect. Yeah. That would be risk-free, because if I hit the goal, then that means I've got enough to produce the book.
Right.
Whereas if I only got 30% of the way there, I mean, what am I going to do with everybody's money? You know, I'd have to find some way to refund it, and I couldn't do the book for that amount. So I set the goal to be $15,000.
Yeah.
Which sounds like a lot of money, and it is. But in the publishing world, that's sort of where things start. You can't really do much if you have anything less than that. Hmm. But it's not like you're investing in a new television or a car or something like that. You're investing in basically stock of a product that you're then going to use to sell and make some money, hopefully.
Yeah.
And so I figured $15,000 would get me 1,000 copies of the book at some limited specs that I had. It was, the original design was 8 inches square, and had some, you know, fairly basic paper and that kind of stuff. And I figured if I can hit that goal, then I can make a go of it. I can at least try this and see what happens.
Yeah.
And you can pretty much guarantee that friends and family are going to come on board with enough poking and prodding. Mm. And so, you know, you might get, you know, between 10 and 30% of whatever money you need from that group of people. But beyond that, you need to sort of look at the internet at large, and you have to spend a lot of time marketing and pushing that, just about full-time work.
Yeah,
trying to be your own promotion engine, your own marketing team, to get the word out and generate interest. And I had a few lucky breaks along the way. I had some great media exposure throughout that process. Indiegogo had they'd put me in one of their newsletters, and that was helpful. I had 5 minutes of airtime in between shows on the This Week in Tech Studios. At the round table sitting in with Leo Laporte.
Yeah.
And I had, you know, a few little shout outs here on This Week in Photo and that kind of stuff. In addition to all the, you know, the Facebook, the Google Plus, the, even a little bit on Twitter, anywhere that I could, you know, not really do a hard sell, but say, hey guys, you want to see this happen?
Yeah.
Come and help out. And, you know, I find that the audience was far more receptive to that than if I had produced a book and said, all right, it's now for sale. Who wants one? Mm. I think that I signed up for a few Indiegogo campaigns myself because I wanted to see the product exist.
Yeah.
And I wanted to feel like I was a part of that success.
Yeah.
And so you can generate a larger number of contributors and people that are helping you out simply by asking for it and saying, you know what, if I don't get enough help, this isn't going to happen,
right.
And so if I can get everybody behind me, then this will take shape, and it will be a material possession that you'll have in about a year's time.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I mentioned this a few weeks ago in a podcast, but I learned a long time ago that people are a lot faster with their mouths than their wallet. And, you know, if you just send out the word and say, okay, I'm thinking of doing this, who's interested? You might get 100 people saying, oh yeah, I'm going to do that, I'll do that. And then when it actually comes to putting some money down, then you find maybe 10, 20% actually will pay the money for something. So if you know, just by forcing the issue and actually getting the money or the commitment to pay the money up front is huge, really, when you're producing something that you've got to have X amount of dollars before it can even start. So I think that, I mean, I said briefly earlier, the timing, these kind of services have only really just started to take off. And I've invested in Kickstarter projects as well. And I think that they are, yeah, they're just a great idea for someone that has exactly that, a great idea, but doesn't have the funding, or maybe has the funding, but doesn't want to take the risk. I think, like I say, the forcing the issue and actually making people give you a promise that they will buy the product if you create it is just changing the way people are doing projects.
It's very freeing to individuals. You know, the previous publishing world, like I would have had to have gone to a publisher.
Yeah.
And I would have had to, you know, made all sorts of concessions and, you know, I'd probably have to, maybe they would pay me in advance or maybe I would get royalties, but there'd be a contract involved to figure all that out. And generally, it's not very fair towards the author. You know, of course, it favors the publisher.
Right.
And rightly so. I mean, they're employing far more people than just the author. But, you know, you get the smaller share of it. And you'd always have somebody, I don't want to say breathing down your neck, but you would have people telling you, it's like, well, you know, this might not fit a general audience, or maybe you could cut this because we're trying to cut down the cost of the book, or maybe you could elaborate on this. And so you're sort of bending to the will to some degree of somebody else. Mm. And because my book was fairly specialized and niche and technical and in some ways just an oddball topic, you know, some of the stuff that I'm rambling on about, you know what, I might talk about why triangle snowflakes are cool, and yes, I can do a 2-page spread on that because I said so.
Yeah.
and so having that amount of freedom is kind of fun. Yeah. And it's also a little scary, though, because I don't know if anybody's going to find interest in that kind of stuff. Mm. But it's also less risky because regardless of what's in there, people have already said they're buying it. And so I know for sure that I've got that, the funds to produce the book in hand. Mm. And that I can sort of go forward and make the book that I want. And if I sell more because people love it, then I sell more. If not, then I'm stuck with, a room full of books for the rest of my life.
Yeah. So in the end, you know, you did the Indiegogo project. You met your goals, but...
And exceeded it.
Exactly. So you created more books than you'd actually promised. So obviously, you know, you've got stock now. So how was that all planned out? Was that like the idea from the start?
So the idea from the start, of course, was to produce as many books as I could. But when I passed the funding goal, I also increased the book size.
Yeah.
You know, it's now, I think, 9 inches square, and improved the cover quality to have a nice sort of semi-gloss, where parts of it are gloss, parts of it are matte. It looks really sharp.
Yeah.
And improving the whiteness of the paper that's used and that kind of stuff. And so I tried to do all of that, and I was able to produce 3,000 copies of the book as well. Mm. Now, at no small amount, though, because I was able to raise $25,000.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love being so transparent about this, because the book from the very beginning has been, you know, all the numbers have been public knowledge, and it's so much fun to just, you know, go out there and play with these numbers. Mm. But it's... So the printer that I had used was one that I had been familiar with in the past, because they print Outdoor Photography Canada, which is a magazine that I write for quite often. I've got a column in there in every issue, and a few feature articles now and then. I got one coming up in the next issue as well. Mm. And so I've seen my images printed from this printer. And in fact, they did an article on my snowflakes early on in my career. And so I had that as an example, how the print quality would look with those images. And I was on board. You know, it looked good. Mm. And they recommended that the same paper type and actually upgraded it a little bit. Mm. And so, you know, when it went through their pre-press department, they picked up all sorts of little things, like, you know, the bleed on this page is, you know, 1/16th of an inch not long enough. You know, do you want to go and fix that? Or if you notice on the book, the spine does not have the gloss coating around the spine. And they had said, well, if you put it there, there's a chance that when it gets bound, it might crack. Mm. And so do you want to fix that? And then they gave me a whole list of things that, you know, that should be improved and fixed along the way.
Yeah.
There was one thing, though, that caused a lot of turmoil that they didn't quite mention, and they probably should have, and it resulted in a complete reprint of the entire book project.
Wow, what was that?
So, for those that aren't familiar, the press printing world is quite a bit different from the photographic printing world, where you're using an inkjet printer, and we talked about that before, and there's no end to the details and stuff that you can talk about with regards to that. But when you have press printing, there's two main types of presses that can be used. One is called a web press. Yeah. And this press technology has paper on a gigantic spool. We're talking huge, like floor to ceiling width of paper. And it feeds through a press under tension, and it goes through four different colors, cyan, yellow, magenta, and black. Not necessarily in that order. I can't remember exactly. But the CMYK printing process, and it goes through and applies the ink from special plates that they have made up that then get transferred onto a rubber blanket, they call it, and then it goes onto the paper. And it goes through all of those, and then it goes through a heater that in a matter of a couple of seconds will completely dry the ink, and then it goes through an automated folding process. And this technology has been around for probably centuries at this point. The machine that had printed the book, I think, was built in the 1970s, but retrofitted with some digital controls. The problem was, for those that haven't seen my snowflake images, a lot of the backgrounds on the images are black.
Yeah.
Or very close to black. You know, they're very ink heavy.
Yeah.
And when you have paper that's under tension and you add a lot of moisture to it in the form of ink, and then you very quickly dry that, it causes the pages to ripple.
Okay.
And so, you know, this was one of those things where, you know, in the pre-press department, they probably should have mentioned something about that. It hadn't been mentioned at that time. I'd actually inquired about another type of printing technology, which I'll mention in a little bit, but they didn't offer any advantage to going to it, except for the higher price, which certainly isn't an advantage. So, the books came in. I was only on press for the first couple of pages to come off the press.
Yeah.
And one of the pages had come off, and I had seen this little rippling. I think the technical term is fluting. And the main press person just kind of shrugged their shoulders and gave me some literature on it and said, well, there's no way to avoid it. And so I'm thinking, okay, well, will that settle out? And he said, maybe. And so I'm not really feeling too confident about that. The books arrived, and that page rippling, I guess, had amplified over, because a lot of the pages had that same thing in roughly the same sequence.
So I'm going to jump in here, because I you sent me a copy from the first press run and the second, and that was the only difference that I could find, and I was trying to figure out why it was. But when I look at the books, I hold the two books together and look at them from the top. The first one is rippled. All of the pages in perfect synchronization are rippled, and you can see it from the top, can't you?
And yes, you can, especially from the top.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out what the difference was, and that was the only thing I could find. But I could not for the life of me guess why that had happened. I thought, I actually sent you an email just before we started talking and asked if the paper was thinner, but I guess it isn't. Did you change the paper?
It is, but we'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
So, you know, there's so many things for me to learn in this process, right? And so I've not been exposed to this, and I'm lending on the knowledge of others, or leaning on it rather, to build up my own knowledge and my own experience. And so I get the idea that, okay, this is a problem, but, you know, I was given a list of all these other problems, and so what's going on here? And they said, well, you know, if the books sit for a while, the rippling will go away. And I'm thinking, well, I don't have a little while. I got to get this book out before Christmas. And especially when the books would have to sit out and be exposed to air, the rippling will fade, but it won't ever completely go away. And I was thinking to myself, yeah, that's... You know, for the amount of effort that I've put into this project, I'm going to take this all the way home. You know, I'm going to make this, you know, that final mile to the finish line. You know, I'm going to make it, and then I'm just going to keep on running. So, I negotiated with them to reprint the book, and using a different printing technology altogether, and a slightly thicker paper stock, just to be sure. And so the original print run of the book cost around $25,000, which is about the money that I had raised. But the upgrade printing cost was much higher. It was around pretty close to $35,000. And so I figured, well, you know what? You know, if they were willing to eat the cost of the first print run, I'd be willing to pay the difference between the two. And so that's what we did. And so the books were reprinted using the new press technology that should have been recommended into the beginning, but we came to an agreement, and everything's all well and good there. The different press technology that the book was finally printed on is called a sheet-fed press. Where the paper coming into the printer is on, as the name would imply, a whole series of sheets. And so they'll run by one at a time, and as they run through the press, they'll just sort of sit on top of each other and dry naturally without going through a heater. So there's no rippling problem that would be introduced from that press technology. And a slightly thicker paper stock as well, just, you know, to be sure that there's no problems. You know, you don't want to do this a third time, of course. Now, on a stipulation that I would be there for the entire press run and sign off on every page that came off of the press so that the printer and myself are both sure that everything is perfect. Now, to put that in perspective, the book was on press for 36 hours straight. And so, you know, the people on the press, I mean, they rotate, I think, in 12-hour shifts. And so I saw the same guys, and then they went home and spent time with their families and had dinner and slept and came back the next day, and I hadn't done any of that. And I'm still, about every half hour they would call me. They had a little suite on site that I would sort of crawl back up to and lie in a chair for about 15 minutes before the phone would ring, and I'd have to go back down and sign off on another page that was coming off of the press. And it's a good thing that I did, because there was a few issues here and there, not many, but enough that I'm happy that I was there to correct them right on site. And the fun thing was, the first book, and you might have to look closely at some of the snowflake images, especially towards the back, or some of the parts of the book that have screen captures from Lightroom or Photoshop. The colors aren't 100% perfect on every page. And that's because the first press was all corrected by eye. As far as the color and the density and that kind of stuff. And it might run out of spec as that particular signature of pages runs through. A signature is 16 pages. It's one big sheet that gets folded into 16 smaller pages. And so that's sort of how they print it. And so... If one looked good, you know, halfway through the print run, the same pages might not look exactly the same. And so there was a certain amount of inconsistency within their tolerance, they said, but it still kind of bugged me a little bit when some snowflakes turned a little bit blue or turned a little bit magenta. And there was some issues with that I wasn't 100% happy with. But the second print run was calibrated by automated equipment. And you would have been pretty impressed to see this, Martin. And full disclosure, both Martin Bailey and myself are part of X-Rite's Colorati program.
Yeah, congratulations on that. I'm glad that went well.
Yeah. And so I'm thrilled to be a part of that. And my book was actually calibrated by an X-Rite IntelliTrack system. Mm. And this was a lot of fun because what the press operator would do is, at the top of every sheet, there's a small little test chart that runs along the top boundary that then goes into this scanner. And so they'll calibrate it every time a new page is going through. And periodically, like every 5 minutes or so, the people on the press would just pull out one of the sheets, run it through the calibrator, and it would on the fly recalibrate the entire printer to, like, without stopping or changing anything, to make any adjustments that were necessary.
That's cool. So
the consistency across the entire press run is pretty stable, and it's nice to see that the colors come out exactly as they should.
So when you say that were they looking at the page, or are they looking at the little patches of color that they print on the side of things, for that? What were they actually reading? The pages, the printed pages of the book itself?
So they would be reading that test chart automatically.
Okay.
And they would be doing a visual check across the page, and that's what I was doing as well. So they would put it under some special, full spectrum lighting, and they would let me inspect it as close as I'd like. And I would point out, okay, well, this one section here looks a little bit too blue. Can you adjust the calibration and get back to me on that? And then a few minutes go by, and a fresh page comes out, and I take a look at that. It's like, all right, that's perfect. Go with it, or can you make these further adjustments? And then when they had that as a reference, and the calibrator also doing its thing, those two in conjunction made the entire run, stable throughout, and they would make sure that it stayed that way. And I've when I got all the books here, when the second print run arrived, I opened up some boxes at random, and I looked at the same pages, some pages that were problematic on the first print run, and they were all perfect. And that alone just made me breathe a sigh of relief. And the pages on the second print run were perfectly flat.
Yeah.
And the book's actually a slight little bit thicker too, because of that thicker page quality.
Yeah, I could see that.
And so now I've got the new books in my hand, and when I say breathe a sigh of relief, I hadn't done that for months, staying up at night just because, you got too much to worry about. There's a lot on the line, because it's not just a book project. I'm putting a lot of myself into this project.
Yeah.
And you have to, when you're wearing all the hats, I'm the photographer, but I'm also the editor. I'm also the writer. I'm also the layout designer, the publicist, and doing all the stuff with the printing. And so, with all that going on, it kind of bothered me that as soon as I let the book get out of my hand, something did go wrong. But up until that point, and after everything was solved, I was like, okay, now we can move on. That was one of the mistakes. I guess I just didn't know enough about the process.
Well, I think you did. You probably already put yourself in a position to know more than most. But applaud you, hats off for actually going in there and spending that 36 hours, because that's dedication that not a lot of people would have done.
I've got a picture, maybe I'll send it to you to put in the blog post, of me standing over all of the pages at the press after they've just all come off of the press.
Oh, send me a copy, please.
I will send you a copy, and please don't judge me. I was awake for about 44 hours at that point, and... And I don't look my best, but man, I'm smiling.
Oh, that's brilliant. So, okay. I mean, obviously we've talked through the process of the printing and everything. Obviously, let's step back a little bit. We talked a little bit about how you can design the book in Lightroom now, and there's the Blurb software and stuff like that. Obviously you wouldn't use that here. How did you actually go through and design the book itself? What software tools did you use?
So I had previously, when I was using Blurb in the past, I had used InDesign, and that's always been an option from Blurb.
Yeah.
And I'd learned some, when I say very basic, I mean very basic InDesign skills for, dropping image blocks and text blocks around and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so I figured, that wasn't too difficult to learn.
Mm.
Let's try and learn a little bit more about that and do the book in InDesign.
Mm.
And so I talked to the printer about the specs that they would need, how much of a bleed they need on the edges, and that kind of stuff. And resubscribed to lynda.com and looked at some of their tutorials there to, you know, I usually just sit through and just with a seemingly blank stare without anybody bugging me, I'll just watch all the basics, you know, every single one back to back before I even open up InDesign. And then I open it up, see how much I can remember and go back to the videos where, you know, I saw something about this. Let's go and find the video relating to it and refresh my memory as I go. And so it, you know, that took a little bit of time, but I learned a new piece of software, a very powerful piece of software in the process.
I've done the same thing. I learned how to use InDesign to a certain degree. Exactly the same way. Yeah, we're probably talking, I don't know, maybe three versions ago now. But I was at the time I needed to learn it and went to lynda.com. It's the best place for learning that kind of software, really.
I completely agree. And so you know, I learned a lot in there that I hadn't thought of to begin with that really sped up the process of you know, building the table of contents at the beginning of the book and building the index at the end of the book and keeping all that stuff linked together. And you just certain things like running headers on the top that have the chapter title that changes when the chapter changes. And even if you drag pages and put them into different sections of the book, all that stuff automatically updates and all of the links in the index and the table of contents automatically update so that the page numbers stay the same. And, you know, If you set that up properly, then it's a joy because you just worry about the content and you don't worry about all the flow and the organization and that kind of stuff. It's just easy.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to say, you know, on the design, to say that you've completed the book yourself, you've done all of your own editing and the layout, you've done a really, really good job. It's very it's impressive. I mean, obviously, your attention, your professionalism, and your attention to detail are shining through in the book.
Well, when I each snowflake takes about 4 hours of editing in Photoshop to complete the image, and so the whole project was in some way attention to detail oriented right from the beginning. And so, I mean, that mentality had followed through to the design. My formal education is in advertising. And so we had taken some graphic design courses and we had learned not InDesign, but Quark Express, which is very similar.
I remember that. Yeah.
And so I had at least some of a background knowledge that I had gained from that into, you know, what layouts look good. And I worked at an ad agency for about a year as well. And so, you know, it's funny, as a photographer, a lot of my my former education skills become very useful in what I do because being a photographer is not necessarily about taking pictures. It's about being a small business owner and it's about wearing all those different hats. And so a background in advertising is very helpful. Prior to that, I had education in software development and I use that all the time when I'm doing web design stuff. And I know Martin, you and I both pull out our hair with the challenges of web designs, but they're challenges that we can take because we've got a certain skill set to handle that instead of giving it off to somebody else, which it might result in fewer headaches, but it's also not going to give you exactly what you want. And you know, for projects like this, getting exactly what I was after was kind of the end goal.
And that's so much of a big part of my, you know, we're touching on here, all of this stuff. We've got very similar backgrounds in that. I mean, I know I'm a bit older than you, but I actually went back to college when I was 20. What would I have been? I was about 28 when I went back to college here in Japan, and we were learning Quark Express, and I did a multimedia course. So literally I was learning Photoshop. I think it was version 4 or 3. I was being taught Illustrator and Macromedia Director and Quark Express. And there was all of this sort of stuff. So, you know, we've got a lot of that similar background, but You mentioned earlier, probably we should add professional photographer or as a business, because you said being a photographer is about being a business owner.
Right.
Obviously, that if you to do it as a business, then yeah, I mean, there's so much stuff. And it's not just about the technical side. I mean, you've got to be an accountant, you've got to be a marketer, you've got to be everything. And until you get large enough that you actually start to take on staff or work with other people, you have to be able to do all of that yourself. So yeah, it's good. I mean, I am thoroughly enjoying it though. And I'm sure you are, you know, just being able to get your hands dirty in so many areas, but then also to be able to learn so many more skills. It's been the last 3 years for me have been incredible as I built. I mean, for me as well as a Westerner, I'm learning all of the intricacies of like corporate law in Japan rather than a Western country. I mean, I probably couldn't speak intelligently about how companies are running in Western countries, but I know a hell of a lot about how it works here in Japan. So it's all great experience.
It is. And you know what, when it all comes down to it, you know, photography used to be an escape for me. You know, it was something where, you know, I'd get away from the doldrums of life and work and that kind of stuff, and I'd get out and I'd be creative. And, you know, it's funny, it kind of comes full circle at this point. Photography is still an escape for me because I get to get away from all the desk work and, you know, all those, you know, wearing the accounting hat and you know, all the other stuff that, you know, is sort of bogging me down. And when I get out and get to be creative in the field with photographs, it's inspiring and it's freeing. And, you know, it's almost like my leisure time becomes sort of my professional career in some way. And it's wonderful that all that stuff can wrap together. Photography, I think, is one of the few careers where that's true. And I'm sure a lot of people might write in and say they've got the same experience, and please do. But, you know, it's almost like it's a gift, you know, being able to do that and making enough to keep the lights on and pay the bills. Projects like this book, you know, really showcase how you can, you know, sort of step up and build something. You know, even if you're an amateur, you know, you could take on a project like this. Maybe it'll kickstart a career. Who knows? It all depends on what you're into and if there's enough of an audience and if what you're doing is you know, is worthwhile. And everybody should have something like that. Everybody should have a project in mind as a photographer. You know, a lot of people that are into photography might not only be into photography. Maybe they're into cars or sports or something else. And if you can wrap photography into that and you can really dig deep and make a project out of that, then go for it. I mean, there's so many opportunities now. The internet has really been, you know, a freedom platform for creativity, because, you know, 10 years ago I couldn't have done this. Even 5 years ago I probably could not have done this. And there was other mistakes made as well, and I'm learning quite a bit about this whole process too.
So, you know, what else did you learn? You know, that we've covered a lot about the process. For example, how did you actually select the media for your book? You know, the paper stock. Did you go in and they showed you various types, or did you know from the start that you were going to go with the same sort of stock that they used for the magazine? How did all of that work?
Well, I used the magazine as a starting point. And when you're talking about paper for these kinds of projects, they'll rate them in a number system from 5 to 1. Five being the worst quality, 1 being the highest quality. And most magazines are printed on a number 3 paper stock. The numbers are roughly related to the white point of the paper, which is how bright the paper stands on its own. And I know that a lot of my snowflakes, I mean, the brightness is important, right? Because you want them to really have a lot of punch. And so I upgraded the one that they had originally given me was a number 3, which is about standard. And I had upgraded that to a number 2. And originally, the book was printed on a 60-pound paper stock, which is, again, pretty standard. The reprint was done on an 80-pound paper stock. And that helps. The pages are then thicker, and it helps prevent transparency, where if you have like text on one side of the page, it makes it less readable through the other side of the page. And so there's all sorts of little considerations, just like when you're picking out paper for your inkjet printer. You know, there's, you know, 7 or 8 bigger companies, and each of them have different product lines, and a lot of them overlap. And so, you know, what's what? You know, there's hundreds of different comparisons you can make. There's fewer choices in the press printing world, but there's still some choices to be made. I think the one that we had gone with is called Opus from Sappi, I think is the name of the paper company. And I was very happy with those results. They had recommended that, and I looked up the specs on their website, and I did some comparisons to other things, you know, versus the price points and this kind of stuff. And it was the best quality that I could reasonably afford. It's not the best paper out there, but to do it with you know, some of the extremely high end stuff would have just about doubled the production cost, and so that wouldn't exactly be feasible. Including the added cost of the reprint. And one thing that I hadn't factored when I was originally doing the Indiegogo campaign, the crowdfunding, is paper is heavy. And this book is big, and it's all paper. And so shipping costs are higher than I had originally anticipated. So I ended up spending around another $10,000 on shipping. and to get that out to all the contributors. So thankfully, you know, I've been selling tons of books since the crowdfunding campaign. And I'm just about to hit the break-even point now. But you know, if you're thinking about a project like this, please consider the cost of shipping, because you know, to ship things to Europe from Canada via airmail, like the cheapest form of it costs between $45 and $55 for a book, and you know, shipping to the US from Canada costs like $20 a book. Within Canada, it can be a little bit cheaper, but only as cheap as say $8 a book, and it goes up from there. And so, you know, all those numbers across, I think I had pre-sold through the crowdfunding campaign around 550 copies of the book. So you add the shipping cost on top of that, especially because, you know, the internet at large is what contributed to this project and would probably contribute to just about any of these projects to make them successful. So, you know, I've shipped books all over the world. I think there's over 20 countries. I just shipped about 4 more books to Norway and Sweden. I guess they love their snow up there. And one last week to Iceland as well.
Nice.
And so, you know, there's a global audience when you do something like this. And it's fun to see, but it's also scary when you see all these orders coming in the crowdfunding campaign from these far off places. And you know that the shipping cost is going to be pretty extreme. In fact, to be honest, I actually lost money on a lot of those international orders because the shipping cost was higher than the contribution to the project. But all's fair in these projects, and I was still more than happy to get them out there to everybody that contributed. And it's amazing when people received the book. It's funny, so many people would take pictures of it and, you know, post that online of them holding the book. And you know, that just that warmed my heart. That made it all feel worth it. And to have people just saying how amazing it was. And, you know, I also ran the risk of people not really replying like that, maybe getting negative feedback because they might not have liked it. And, you know, that would sort of tear me apart. But thankfully at this point, you know, cross my fingers and knock on wood, nobody's complained.
Yeah. So. Well, having received a copy of the original press run and the second one, obviously I can see a little bit of improvement in quality. And I was thinking that the paper thickness had changed. But I can't imagine anybody, if someone has felt it strongly enough to want to actually buy it, obviously you've already got a positive, an indication of positiveness there. People have already paid for a book. When it arrives, I can't imagine it's not going to surpass someone's expectations. You really have done an excellent job with it.
And, well, thank you.
I think it's probably one of those books. I mean, and also, I mean, I noticed that you've got the option to have them, you know, for you to sign them before you send them out. It's one of those books that it may even be, I mean, it's by default, it's in short supply. It's not a big publishing house that's put this out. So I imagine that to a certain degree, they're going to become collector's items, especially as you go on and become an even more internationally famous photographer. And yeah, I mean, you never know.
Don't put me up on a pedestal, but well, no, you never know. You never know, but you look at this too, and the final end of this whole project, you know, okay, so I've got the book and I've shipped it out to everybody, but you know, I'm doing all of the shipping myself and the book, you know, as far as distribution is concerned, you know, for the most part, it's me and it's my website.
Yeah.
And so I have to then continue to keep the marketing buzz going and that kind of stuff. But also, I look and see, okay, well, maybe I want to put it on Amazon and maybe I want to put it in bookstores and that kind of stuff. And that's when things get kind of scary and depressing because, you know, if you're talking about like a physical print book going into a physical bookstore, we have Indigo Books here in Canada. They own a couple of brands like Chapters and Kohl's, and they might exist in other countries as well, but they're brick and mortar bookstores. Mm. And they'll take books on consignment on per store levels. I tried to get in touch with their main distributors, but they wouldn't even give me the courtesy of a response. Mm. But they would take 40% of the sticker price right off the bat.
Yeah.
And so then I would get the remaining 60%, of which I have costs associated with, like the production and all that. And so there's that as an option. Mm. The other option is if you go to Amazon and do Amazon for fulfillment, they'll take 55% of the sticker price.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, I would have to pay to ship the books to them. And it's funny, they request that you use either FedEx or UPS because you have to pay, like for me in Canada, shipping to Amazon's distribution centers in the US, I have to pay duty when it crosses the border.
Mm.
So even with the cheapest methods from FedEx, it would cost me more than my profit would be to ship the books to Amazon. I would lose money on every sale.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking, okay, well, this is just stupid.
Yeah.
I mean, how do I get to the bigger audience? So you're right. You know, there are still some challenges to overcome.
Mm.
Right now, every book that's in people's hands is passed by me to some degree.
Yeah.
And I'm thrilled when people want it autographed and that kind of stuff. And for the beginning, you know, it was funny. I was trying to get through all of the books as fast as I could to get them shipped out. So up until a little while ago, almost every book that went out, everything was still in the queue. And of course, everything through the crowdfunding campaign had been autographed. Now I can start being selective about it.
Yeah.
And now that I'm caught up with all of my orders.
Yeah.
But it's just that final step now to get it noticed by a larger audience is tricky. And there's no way to keep it all in my hands anymore. And so now I'm at sort of the crossroads of whether or not I should sort of let it go or keep it close to my heart and to see, you know, what distribution could make of it. But I know I won't make any money on it. So there's some questions to be had and there's still some lessons to be learned.
Yeah. Well, I think that you've got the book now. You've still got. I mean, do you have a fair amount of stock left? I know.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Yeah.
So I've got about 2,000 copies left.
Oh, cool.
So I've gone through 1,000 by now. I've about 550 through the crowdfunding campaign, and then I've sold a couple of hundred more since then. And so you know I'd probably be selling at least a couple of hundred, if not more, a month at this point, you know, especially being the winter and all. I missed the Christmas season. You know, the books arrived at my door in very early December, and I really struggled to just ship them out to people before Christmas, but I didn't have the time to do much in the way of promotions. And that's a necessary thing in order to make people aware when they're doing their Christmas shopping.
Yeah.
So there's always next year for that too. And this is the kind of book that doesn't go out of style from 1 year to the next. And I guess that's an important lesson to learn too when you're doing this kind of stuff. You know, try as hard as you can to make it timeless.
Oh yeah, for sure. So you've obviously given us a whole lot of stuff to think about here, and I think that the understanding postage costs is priceless. You know, obviously people generally tend, I mean, I've been shipping prints around the world for years now. And I've got my own costs down. But when you start something new like this, it's difficult to figure it all out. You know, obviously, the best thing to do is to find out how much it's going to weigh and go and build all of that in from the start. But it's easy to say that now that you've given us the information on how you slipped up in that area, you know. So I think it's a good, you know, anyone that is thinking of doing something like this, this could be an invaluable reference. So I'm really pleased that we got to talk about all of this today.
And the final question then, Martin, that I have for you is, have you tried to go and photograph any snowflakes?
I haven't done that. You know what? We don't get a lot of snow that it's very sticky and wet and just In Tokyo here, it just melts straight away. And on my tours, although we get some beautiful snow, we're generally concentrating on the wildlife, and there's not much time to actually grab a macro and go and actually photograph the snow. And what I mean, I'd love to do it, but the other big problem is that because it's a landscape and wildlife tour, the participants generally don't have the weight allowance to bring a macro lens with them as well. So, you know, we're in the situation where even on my tours, although we're surrounded by beautiful quality snow, we don't get a chance to do it very much. A few people do bring macros and they'll have a play with that stuff, but it's not something that we're able to really do. But you know, I mean, the just looking at the book itself makes me want to grab a woolly mitten and give it a try. And I think that's another beautiful thing about the book itself. It inspires people to give it a try.
It's not difficult to do. Mm. I mean, the editing is kind of complicated, but if you just want a single shot of a snowflake, I mean, the process is really laying out a black mitten. Well, at least that's what I do, but you know, feel free to choose whatever you'd like. Mm. Having a snowflake fall on it and then getting in with the right angle at a good enough magnification and fire away. I mean, the process, you know, if you distill it down that far, is pretty simple. Mm. And it's a heck of a lot of fun seeing all these different crystals in your viewfinder and then taking those images of something that is truly fleeting. I mean, it's only going to exist the way you photograph it for a couple of minutes, less than an hour for sure.
Mm. Well, I remember we talked about this in a previous chat of ours as well, but I remember you talking about the fact that, you know, the woolly mitten works well because it's got the fibers that keep the snowflake suspended and you know, away from the what warmth would be in the mitten, right?
Right. So it acts as an insulator. Mm. And, you know, it's funny because in some images I can see where it's making contact with the fibers of the mitten at one or two points, and I can see it starting to melt at those points.
Yeah.
And so you can imagine that if it was on a flat surface, like, you know, I can't imagine what other flats, like the, you know, the cover of my barbecue is a flat black surface and that kind of stuff. But the snowflake would lay flat on that. And if it's making contact at every single point, then it's probably going to start melting at just about every single point there as well. And so it'll last an even shorter amount of time, especially at the more comfortable shooting temperatures around the freezing point. You know, it's they'll be fine at around minus 20, but you certainly wouldn't be. And so it also, you know, a good contrast for the background. But because of those fibers lifted away from a background, it's easy to make the background completely out of focus. And there's a few very simple tricks in focus stacking to really just push it all out of focus pretty simply and use a cloning tool to clean up the rest. And you know, it's one of those things where, sure, I mean, snowflakes are a very, very niche subject. But if you do anything in the world of macro photography, a lot of those techniques sort of apply in much the same way, whether you're photographing flowers or insects or water droplets. I do a lot of that as well. And a very similar workflow is used when I'm doing water droplets and refracted images and water droplets and that kind of stuff as to the snowflakes.
Yeah.
So a lot of those puzzle pieces of photography are translatable to other skills and other genres.
Yeah. I've done focus stacking and had a lot of fun with that. But yeah, I mean, you go into all of this detail in the book as well. It's not just a coffee table book as such that it's just to pick up and look at the pretty pictures. You actually go into all of these details in the book. So it's a great reference as well.
Oh yes, be prepared.
Well, no, as I say, I mean, I know how scientific you are. You always know all of the terminology and everything, and it's just a pleasure to look through. So I've got a whole bunch of books that I have received over the years, and obviously there are some books make you want to read them instamatically. You know, you've got to jump in. I had to leave these on my table for a couple of weeks, unfortunately, because they came at a busy time and I was trying to sort of get a lot of other stuff done. But once I cracked them open, I was glued. It was like, oh, that's how he does it. So yeah, lots of incredibly good information in there. And so what I'll do is, I mean, obviously we're here to talk about the process, but I will put a link to the the page where you can actually go and buy a book, a copy of this. But it's at skycrystals.ca if you're just listening and want to jump over there. But Don obviously does have a few copies left, and it's a beautiful book if you're interested.
And at this point, you know, I've put in a lot of effort, and I've effectively made no money, but I am so happy. Yeah. You know, it's one of those things that at this point, it really hasn't paid off in any financial way. Mm. But if more people buy the book, then it certainly would. Mm. But man, even if it didn't, you know, the learning experience throughout this, learning an entirely new industry in the press printing world, and learning new software, and gaining a lot of experience in every facet of self-publishing, from the crowdfunding all the way through to fulfillment. Man, yeah. it's been a great experience, and I can't wait to do it again. I don't know when. It'll probably be a couple of years. Mm. But you know, I'm still energized from this first process. Mm. And I'm so excited to think, okay, well, what is the next one going to be? Yeah. And yeah, it'll be fun again. Hopefully fewer mistakes the second time around. Mm. And still a lot more to learn.
Well, you've obviously learned so much. And the way you've done this is, and sharing this with us today is probably going to be one of the biggest resources that I can think of on doing something like this. So I'm really pleased that we had a chance to chat about this today. And I also, I mean, on what you just said, it's not always about the money. As you're attesting to here, I didn't make a hell of a lot of money on my Pixels to Pigment workshop that I did last year. In fact, I lost a few thousand dollars. But I got to meet some great people. I got to travel around the world. And you learn a lot. You meet people. You do things that if it doesn't work out financially, you figure out how to make it work next time. But having the desire to go out and learn something new like that, it's just great. You know, yeah, I enjoy doing this sort of thing. And I think that being able to share it like this will help others to not make the same mistakes that we did. And you know, it's all good stuff.
And I also encourage anybody out there that's thinking about this, but we might not have answered a question. Send me an email, because I'm more than happy to talk about this and fill in any gaps. I can't think of anything that I haven't mentioned just now, but I'm always happy to hear back from you. Yep. And you can find that on skycrystals.ca. The contact information is there as well to get in touch and let me know what you think.
Sounds good. So you can also catch up with Don at don.com. So that's donkom.ca as well. But I'll put links to all of this and a few photos in the blog post. And that's going to be at mbp.ac/406 for episode 406. So Don, really, thanks very much for joining us today. I've had a blast talking as usual, and I'm sure it won't be many months before we're doing this again, but thanks very much.
Oh, thank you again for having me, Martin. It was a blast.
Okay, so thanks very much for listening today. Remember that you can find me on Google+, Twitter, Facebook, etc., and links to everything that I'm up to are at martinbaileyphotography.com. So do drop by and take a look. I'll be back next week with another episode, but in the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.